The other person I want to recognize tonight before I turn it over to Stefano is Therese. Oh, there you are, you're here. Therese Rowe. Therese, please stand. Therese is our music directress here. And when I got here 9 years ago, Therese and I sat down and I gave her a list of music that she wasn't allowed to play. And I said, I can't have this, and these are songs that I like. And from there, our conversations in the last 9 years have developed into, I think, what is one of the finest music programs in the city of Charlotte. And I know a lot of people come to our parish because they like the music. And every time that we do a funeral, every time that we do a wedding, I always get comments about how beautiful the music is. And that's mostly because of Therese. So, Therese, thank you for giving us sacred music for us. And lastly, I want to introduce our speaker tonight, Stefano Monaco. Stefano is a beloved parishioner and someone that is my friend. And I've learned a great deal about the Latin Mass from this man to my class. Stefano is in charge of our Latin Mass altar boys. And we have a great group of young men and boys who serve the Latin Mass here. And they owe their training to Stefano. Comes to our parish with a great wealth of knowledge, not just about sacred music, but about the Latin Mass in general. And so, Stefano, I'm so grateful to you, A, for speaking tonight, B, for all the ways that you've enriched the knowledge in this parish. So, without further ado, I turn it over to Mr. Monaco.
Thank you all very much. Nice. Thank you. I don't know why you're stuck with me tonight on this subject. As Father introduced, we have an excellent music director here, but she's shy. And so for some reason, I stick the accountant on you. Now, I know what you're saying, an accountant teaches sacred music. I might as well leave now before I fall asleep and embarrass myself. But don't worry about it, because I only have a few pages to cover today. So you're not going to have to worry too much about it. You know, one of the reasons, one of the things I'm hoping you're going to take away from this, right, is, as Father said, we have a fantastic music program here at St. Anne's. And I think you're going to find as we go through it, it's because it aligns to the will and the heart of what Holy Mother Church teaches us is sacred music. And we align it the way that it does, and I think that's what people begin to see. And if you're curious about why things are the way they are, the way we do it around here at St. Anne's, I think you're going to see, because we're going to be following the men's case, which is the mind of the church. So, that's what we're going to do. Now, you know, whenever you're talking about, now, because if you can't tell, I'm not from Gastonia, right? Trying to tie an Italian dango podium onto a handheld microphone is just horrendously torturous. But I'm offering it up for all of you, because you might not be able to hear it. But anyways, why is there such emotion and controversy whenever we think about sacred music, right? You can't talk about it without having some kind of a controversy. You have the people over here that are all these lovely choir boys in New York City, and then you have, you know, the guitar and the keyboard on the other side, right? Inevitably, you look at a church or a group of parishes across the spectrum. This is what you find. Why is this, right? Part of it is that music is part of our senses. It creates emotion in us, hence it becomes their emotion. So, when we think about our senses, the things that drive emotion, right? We have, and your hearing is very dark, because these are old pictures. So you take your sense of sight, and you look at an old family picture, and if you could see these a little bit more clearly, you would see a very handsome young boy in his foolish pictures from a very long time ago. But, you know, how many of you have gone through a photo, and you see that one picture, and it brings a tear to your eye, or joy to your face, right? And it does it because of the emotion, the sight, and the visualization of that moment that kind of brings. The same with smells, right? You go to grandma's house, and the pot of sauce is cooking, or the cookies are there, right?
her perfume, those smells that you knew you were in Mona's house. You just knew it. You could walk by some lady in the street and say, oh, I know that perfume. As we use our senses, it invokes emotion and things. The same with listening and hearing, right? The sounds that we hear, the music that we hear, brings back memories. You hear that one song on the radio, right? Well, what about it? That's our song, or that wedding song that we had, right? It brings those emotions, they come flooding back. Whenever you're thinking about, one of those songs, it will bring a tear to your eye, because you're going back, it's taking you back emotionally. This is why music becomes so emotional usually in Harrison, right? It's because everyone has these, it invokes these emotions, and it's because within Mother Church, uses those senses to set and invoke the mystery of God for us, right? Sight again, you think about your photographs here, and St. Anne's has as well in Spain, you know, beautiful painting, beautiful architecture. Who can look at St. Peter's or at the Sistine Chapel or our own Europe and we just feel drawn in? So first we have the sight, the use of our sight that brings us in, and smell, incense, candles, the flowers. You know, there are times when you could be blindfolded and walk, and I could then take you into a building and you would know you're in a church just by the smells within that building. Just like the sauce and the cookies get at Grandma's curtains. The same as the incense and the candles and the flowers get into the very fiber of the parish. And then music. Music, the way it sets the setting, right? Music is an important component of that setting. Now, because I talk like this, first, before I go, let's take an example from the year 400 for what St. Augustine said about music. The year 400, okay? That's a lot far away, right? Oh, how I wept, deeply moved by your hymns, songs, and the voices that echoed through your church. What emotion I experienced in them. The sounds flowed into my ears, distilling the truth in my heart. A feeling of devotion surged within me, and tears streamed down my face, tears that did me good. What he heard in Anno Domini 400 moved him. This is part of what music should be doing for us, right? Now, because I don't want you to fall asleep, right, we're going to have some interaction. So here's the first interaction piece that we have to do. So, what I want you to do is I want you to close your eyes, and then I'm going to play something. And as you listen to it, think about the first thing that comes into your mind. Your eyes closed. Dog, what? Dorothy. But guess what? God's beyond the rainbow. Couldn't you say God? Somewhere over the rainbow, there is God, right? Well, you can make that a religious song. No, that's not what came into your mind when you heard that. Something else came into your mind. Kansas, tornadoes, right? Those are the things that came into your mind. Close your eyes again. You're not done. Now, that's a great, the name of that is Imperial March.
Why couldn't we play that for His Excellency the Bishop when he comes down the aisle, right? No, because you wouldn't think the bishop's coming, you'd think Darth Vader's coming. Right? But it's a beautiful march. Why not use that? Maybe a bride could use it. Think about it. Because it has another connotation in your mind, right? Another connotation altogether.
Close your eyes, I'm not done yet. This is the fun part, to get you to the boring lane.
From tapping on that one, right? You want to do a little jitterbug, right? That name's in the mood. I'm in the mood for Mass. No. No, you're not in the mood for Mass. You're in the mood for dancing. You know, there's one saying that if music gives you a beat that makes you stomp your feet, that's grounding you to earth, not lifting you up to heaven. Keep that in mind as we think. If a sound has a beat grounding you down to earth, it's keeping you on earth, not lifting you up. Okay, we're not done yet. Close, but you can always see this a couple. Isn't it fun? Close your eyes. First thing that entered your mind is what?
4th of July.
Kate Smith, 4th of July, watching fireworks, right? 1812, you could relate it, yeah? Right? But God was mentioned, God bless America, we could put that at the end of Mass. And trust me, I've been to parishes that did that. I once went to a parish, and it was holy, the Most Holy Trinity Sunday. And Memorial Day weekend. When I left that Mass, I knew it was Memorial Day. The word Holy Trinity wasn't said in the whole Mass. From God Bless America at the end to Montezuma's Revenge, what's the Halls of Montezuma, whatever, right? That one was played at the beginning. I mean, a beautiful song, you know, a fun, you know, I came to Charlotte via Boston. We have the Esplanade, we have the Pops who play 1812 Overture, fireworks along the river. I love this song. I'll belt it out as loud as anybody else, right? But I don't want to hear it at Mass. Right? Okay. Last one. Close your eyes. First thing that comes to your mind. Heaven. So now we just heard a bunch of examples there.
This is might not be a big trouble. A bunch of examples of how music can set an environment and can set a tone, and why music does matter. All right? Now, you know, you might say, well, Stefano, you know, why do you think there's all this discrepancy, this big spectrum all the way around the world, from really horrible music to just really beautiful music? Maybe Holy Mother Church isn't very clear. Maybe Holy Mother Church doesn't really tell us what we should be doing. So, you know, if we just take a look at the last century, okay? The 20th century. In the last century, just to show you, this is what Holy Mother Church had to say about sacred music. I'd say there's more than a couple of things on that list, right? 11 documents, 11 documents specifically from 1903 until 2003 were put out by Holy Mother Church telling us what sacred music is. Now, you don't have to read all 11 of those, but if you want to argue, I have them all right here, so don't worry, come on, I'm with you. Happy to do it. But let's talk a little bit. Let's find out what in these 11 documents did Holy Mother say the definition of the church is. You want to think of, Holy Mother says there's really two kinds of church. There is profane, also known as secular, and there is religious music, right? So that's in the mind of Holy Mother Church. She thinks of profane music or secular music and religious music. Now, further divided into the religious music, right, is a subset called sacred music. Right? Now, this is a bit of a difference than what most people would think. So, you have religious music, non-religious music, and then sacred music as a subset of religious. So, what does Holy Mother Church say that sacred music is? So, the Church's definition is that sacred music is liturgical music. It's used for the sacred liturgies, and it has three criteria to meet in this space. It has to be holy, it needs to be sound, and it needs to be universal. Religious music, or the other non-religious music, is devotional music. This aids and supports the faith, but it's not part of the liturgy. Alright? So here a lot of devotional music that's done, praise and worship music, which is quite beautiful, is in here. And then profane is the secular, and that's all other music. Alright? And specifically, Pope Pius X in 1903 said that the three characteristics of sacred music: it must possess holiness and soundness of form, and from these two qualities, a third will spontaneously arise, and that is universality. So those are three critical things: holy, sound, and universal. So, let's go a little deeper in this. What is holy? Holy means it is set aside only for glorifying God and the unification of the people. It is not everyday music. It is not everyday music. That is why Somewhere Over Top of the Rainbow isn't going to work. Alright? That is where Whoopi Goldberg singing My Guy isn't going to work. Not ordinary, it is not every day. Now the harder one of these to understand is soundness of form. So what does this say, okay? So soundness of form is the fact that if you think about the times in the Mass when music is taking place, there's a length of time for the liturgical action to happen. soundness of form means that when those different elements happen at various times in the Mass, that they should be uniform, they should be sound, they should be similar. You should be able to, the specific word is music should synthesize diverse ritual elements into a unity, drawing things together in a succession of liturgical actions into a cogent whole. The other way to look at this is, does the music that's happening during the Mass, does that sound similar to what's happening in the Divine Office? All right? And when we think about things like Gregorian chant, it's the same all the way through. It's a unity, it's a soundness of form. And then I think the easiest one to understand, but it's the one that really most people fall down on the most, and that is universality. Universality. Sacred music to be used in the Holy Catholic's liturgy should be universal. It should be supranational, equally acceptable to diverse cultures. So, polka music, well, I love it. I love the polka like beautiful, and that might be great for Polish or Polish Americans. I don't know that it's going to play very well in Kenya or in New Zealand. And African bongo drums may be beautiful in Kenya, but I don't know how well that's going to go over in France, right? Because they're local, they are not universal. And when you think about the Latin Church, what is the universal unifier of the Latin Church? And that is Latin. So things that are Latin tend to unify as well. So if you have music tied to the Latin, it gives you that universality. And here's the other way to think about universal. If you think about a concert, and you go to a sacred music concert, or there's some Christmas concert at Symphony Hall, what kind of music are they playing all around the world? They're playing Mozart, or they're playing a Palestrina, or they're playing something like that. They're not playing Angel's Wing, or Eagle Wings, or whatever, right? They're not. It's because it's not universally recognized as beautiful. You go onto YouTube and you put in Siku Chervis that we just heard there, that last one, and you will see it sung on every continent, in every place, everyone understanding what it is. That is universality. All right? Now, here's the thing to think about other non-religious, or non-sacred music, but other religious music. So here's where traditionalists, like myself, can fall into a trap and say that the only kind of music in the whole world is Gregorian chant in Latin, and everything else, you know, even if you're sitting at a campfire, that's all you should sing. Well, what do we say? You know, sacred music is for the liturgy, right? It's not every day. So other religious music, absolutely, that devotional music has its purposes, right? It could be an Italian marching band carrying a statue of St. Joseph in the streets of Boston. There's a handsome young fellow in that picture too, that you can see. Or it could be Catholic praise and worship music with a bunch of Catholic scouts that are out on a mountaintop somewhere on a retreat. There is nothing wrong with sound theological praise and worship music in that setting. Now, if they're doing a Mass up there in the mountain, no. But to enjoy it, absolutely. Absolutely, it would be totally appropriate. And I forgot to mention, we talked about concerts, and the fact that you can hear some of these beautiful Masses in concert halls, right? One of the beautiful things about the Carolina Catholic Chorale, and hopefully many of you have been able to hear some of those, is that they're taking the music out of the concert hall and reinserting it into the liturgy that it was written for. And that's an amazing thing. I actually had someone in the Carolina Catholic Chorale that said, oh, I can't believe how well the timing lines up. We were just done singing it in the bell rang. That's right, because these things were written to cover a certain period of time. That's the way. It's beautifully timed that way. Hence, soundness of form that we talked about before. Causes building some school. Alright? So we have to, as traditionalists, if we fall into that camp, we have to honor other religious music. And St. Paul XII writes this: we must honor that music because it exercises great and salutary force of power for souls of the faithful. It's used in churches during non-liturgical settings and ceremonies, and it can be used outside for solemnities. And why is it really good? Here's the reason. Because it helps to enculturate people, right? Tunes of these hymns are often sung in the language of the people, so it's done in the vernacular, which, almost by definition, is going to make them non-universal, right? So they're not going to really work for sacred music. Memorized with almost no effort or labor, because they're easy, and children learn these, and they actually can't get it. They're a catechism. They're a catechism. You learn your faith. Now, Christmas carols tend to fall into this category, right? And how many of us know who use Christmas carols? Think about where you hear Christmas carols all day. Macy's, Target, Santa Claus ringing a bell on the little stereo beside, right? And they're in English. Now, those are pretty much universal because they're so overplayed in every part of the world. But those are the types of things. But that is a very, what we should be seeing in the world. It's beautiful stuff, right? So the last one that we haven't talked about too much, and I don't really need to say, is just to remind you, we've talked about sacred music, which is a subset of rather religious music, into the profane music. And here's the kind of, you know, your band and your bagpipe, and your poodle skirt music, your lounge, Vegas lounge act music. Then you've got some of that stuff I need to go near, because I think that really enters into the true world of profane. By the real definition, all right? So you're getting a sense of what, you get the sense of what Holy Mother Church defines as that music. Now, why? How did that come about? That's where we want to go into a little bit now, right? And that is, we want to talk a little bit about the history of sacred music and how it developed. And as you can see, this is a timeline. We're starting out at, you know, like 1000 ante Cristo. See, that's the nativity scene. You know, kids, you know what year that is? Zero. Very good. So that's zero. And then we go to Anno Domini all the way up to present day. Alright? So that's our timeline. Watch it. It's very important as we're walking down here and we're going to talk about some of these things. So, where do we start? We start at ancient Jewish worship. Right? Because I'm going to let you in on a secret. Jesus' family was Jewish. You know, if you don't know, they were Jewish. So, and so were all the apostles. And the early church, as it started out, right? So they drew upon ancient Jews. So this is why we're starting there. Now, the last time we all got together, Father Reed got up here to talk about the Holy Mass. He talked about Jewish worship. And he said there were basically two parts about it. He said it much better than I will, but I'm going to paraphrase. There was the readings of the songs, or psalms, right? And there was the sacrifice in the Temple of Jerusalem. Right? So you had the psalms. And the church, Holy Mother Church, inherits the psalms as part of hers. It was what Holy Mother Church used at the beginning for its hymns. These are the sacred texts that she took in because they were Jewish. They got around, they got rid of the old sacrifice, because we have now the Mass, but we still have the readings, and we still read from the Psalms, and then we have the letters from the Apostles, right? So, what happens here then is, we have to think about why. What did the Jews do, and why did they do it? So the Jews had a very unique way of praying. And it was a way of singing, right? And they sang the text. What was most important to the Jews was the text. And why was the text important? Because that was prayer. The text is a prayer. If you read the Psalms, or sing them as they were originally written by David on his harp, but they're talking to the sheep, right? Sing the sheep. Alright? They were sung. But they were sung in what is called, the German historian Martin Hengel called it, sung speech. Sung speech, or we would call it in modern day plain chant. It was a way of saying the words to a melody, but you didn't lose what the words were, because the words were more important than music, right? And this was a very conscious decision by the Jews. Why did they decide it? They wanted their religion of the great God to be different from the pagans, who were wild, and they were a frenzied, intoxicating music, the drums. Anyone who ever sees, you know, the belly dancers and the things, when you see those movies, it was wild. Wild. The Jews wanted to be different, so they had plain chant, because the words were important, not the gyrations. Right? So, this was the foundation, this was the Jewish foundation that the church started to grow out, okay? So, when you move out of that, right, you then start to get to the early church. So, we know the church started when it Pentecost, right? At Pentecost, what happened is the church drew upon its Jewish roots. So, we had the Psalms, as we said. We added the difference. But the church also looked, for those first couple of hundred years, there was a great tension between the Jewish roots of the church and the songs that they used, and the hymns that they used, and the Greek and Roman part. So we read about it in Scripture in the battles of life between Peter and Paul, right? And so there was this great attempt to bring in more of a Greek lyrical style into, and in some cases trying to replace the plain song of the Jewish faith. But here's the problem. A lot of the Greek hymnology at that time started to draw upon Gnostic ideas. Gnostic ideas is a heresy. It was one of the huge heresies at that time. That's as far as I'm going to go farther than going into detail on that. Just know it was bad. All right? They thought they knew it all, right? They thought they knew it. So, the church, the early church, made a very conscious decision to prune the Greek style lyric out and concentrate on plain song within church worship and liturgy. Alright? This ended up being an unbelievable, beautiful thing for the church in the long run, because what directly and organically came out of that was Gregorian chant. Gregorian chant developed out of the Jewish plain song. I looked everywhere for the actual citation, and I couldn't find it. And there's St. John Paul II was doing one of the ecumenical things, and he was with the lead rabbi of Rome, I believe it was. And there was the Sistine Chapel, or one of the choirs was singing a beautiful song, Gregorian chant. And the rabbi leaned over to the Holy Father and he said, I recognize that too. The mode of that particular chant, that rabbi knew from the ancient cantillations that they would do in the Jewish thing. Just to show that the roots of that go back. You'll hear a lot of people say, it goes back to the Middle Ages. It goes back a little further than that, as we're going to see, because we're going to talk now about Gregorian chant. So, Gregorian chant has its foundation in Jewish songs. So there's David again, singing to his sheep out in the field, singing his songs. And if you look at that, that is B.C. 9th century. Okay? That's when those songs were being written and first sung. And then in Gregorian chant, we always talk about Gregorian chant as this monolithic piece of music. It's not. It's really composed of about five different elements. I am certainly not going to worry about that, right? But I will tell you that three out of the five come directly out of Jewish song. Okay? The others came a little bit later, especially with the Divine Office. There were organic developments out of it. But it was clearly something that we can trace the roots back to the 9th century B.C. And then, then comes along in the shadows St. Pope Gregory the Great. Now, he's sitting there in the 6th century. He gets a lot of credit. In fact, it's named after him, right? Gregorian chant. And it was believed at that time that because as it grew, because you go in the 6th century, right? That's 600 years after the early churches started. The church was spreading like wildfire in different places. The chant began to regionalize a bit and get a little bit different. So it was believed
that Pope Gregory helped to unify the chant at that time and sort of codify it and make sure it was used at the right times. Now, modern scholars say that that really isn't, they don't believe that's the case as much anymore. He gets credit for it, but the real credit is really probably Charlemagne, because he unified, he reunified all of the Roman Empire. And when he did that, he brought the chants from Rome and spread it throughout his empire. And that is really what spread a lot of the Roman style chant that later became known by everyone as Gregorian chant. All right, so this is an important element of what this is. Now, so here you have in the 9th century, so that's 1,000 years now. 1,000 years from the time that Christ was walking on the planet, right? And through that 1,000 years, how was Gregorian chant passed down? So you get all these monks, right? And they're sitting there, you know, happy as clams. And here's where it really gets to be beautiful when you start to think about it. And I think this picture starts to put it in perspective. What you see on this picture is an old manuscript. An old manuscript of the prayer. This is the introit for the Sunday of Advent for the Blessed Virgin Mother. And you see words, because what was most important were the words. The words are prayer. And then you see little chicken scratches above the letters and words. Those were the little tick marks that for 1,000 years, through collective memory and little tick marks, is how people knew how to sing this. So if you look at this, and for those of you who've ever been here for our Golden Mass on Advent, the last Sunday, the Saturday usually before, it starts like 6 o'clock in the morning, beautiful. And it starts out with this. That's what that means. So here was it. That's what it looked like way back then, 680. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, notice I said it was passed down by collective memory. So every monastery had some guy who sort of knew how it was and kept it at the beginning. He was the choir master. And he was the one who taught everyone how to do it. He wouldn't share that with anyone, because he knew how to read the chicken books, right? And that's a collective memory. So then comes along, and I'm very proud to say, my cousin Guido. My cousin Guido comes into the picture. My cousin Guido here, he was born in 995, Guido Marco d'Arezzo. And what Guido did, he was a monk. So obviously that family and mine, and so. But he went around and he codified Gregorian chant. He went from monastery to monastery and came up with a way to make it so that you didn't have to have a choral master understanding how to read the chicken marks and understand the pitch and to understand all of that. So he invented the four-line staff that exists in Gregorian notation. He came up with the square notation. You have a picture of it in front of you. If you look at that, if you look at that Salve Regina that you have in front of you, this is thank you to my cousin Guido. You can thank him. It is a four-line staff, modern music, and this was the foundation of modern music later on, right? Those of you who know modern music know that there's a five-line staff, and you have rondos with a little trick. This was what was codified by my cousin. And the good part about this, right, is that now they were able to make beautiful manuscripts with notes that could be shared. So here's a page of one, and it really is too bad that it's not quite as clear as you might want it, but it's a beautiful, you can see just the coloration of these manuscripts. And on this one, which is quite obviously better, this is a beautiful illustration. This particular manuscript is a Kyrie. Kyrie. You've heard that before. I'm sure you've heard that, but it's not that before, right? That's what it looked like in the old manuscript. And how it was used is, here's an example of how it was used. This this happens to be a Requiem Mass, because you can see the catafalque in the middle there with the six candles. But you see the manuscript on a lectern there. And it's a big book, right? It's this massive book, because guess what? They couldn't print stuff very much better. Most of it was monks doing it by hand. So they all had to have this big book, and they had to stand around it and share the same book to read from. Any modern musician knows you have to share music, right? They did it. And here's another example of a page that we have here. You can come up and look at these things afterwards, right? Of what a manuscript page would look like. And to give you a sense of how big some of these books could be, these put them in some scale for you. Right? So I would hesitate to bet that some of you children aren't as big as some of these books. You'd get lost in a page. But they had to be big so they could all be standing around it to read it, sometimes from a distance, right? And reading notes. So now if we think about that beautiful chicken scratch Rorate that we saw on the very front page, this is what it looks like in square notation. Now, where very few of you could probably make any sense out of what's on the left, any of you who have any rudimentary knowledge of music would maybe be able to make something out of what's on the left. But this is what he did, so it allowed the growing chant to continue and to prosper in time. So, this is the way the Gregorian chant developed, and just to give you a sense of it, I'm going to show you a book here. This book is called the Liber Usualis. It is a book of just about every Gregorian chant, at least in the liturgy that's used, whether the Mass or the Divine Office. Pretty thick book, pretty fine print, and you're welcome to come up and look at it after. It's just a massive book, thanks to my cousin Lou. What I also have up here that you can look at is there was work done. This is called the Graduale Triplex, and it shows the Gregorian chant. It shows the Gregorian chant, but it also shows the chicken scratch of two different manuscripts that still exist in the world, so that you can see how the chicken scratch was ultimately turned into square notation. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get a little bit further. How some of the renovations of Gregorian chant is a win. So, here we are, we're coming through, we're developing Gregorian chant, we're now at the year 1000, right? That's where we are, and then Cousin Guido comes, and so for the next 1000 years. So what does Holy Mother Church say about Gregorian chant? The Church inherited from the Fathers, and it is the supreme model. The supreme model of sacred music serving as an element of unity. Why does it say that? It's Latin, it's sung all across the world, it's the same music wherever you are. You can once again go on YouTube, you can put in almost any Gregorian chant or any mass, you can listen to it, and you won't know that it's in another country until they get up for the sermon. I often get lost sometimes when you're listening to some of these masses online and then they get up for the sermon, like, oh, I didn't know that was who that was. You can go to any of these and then find it. So what else does Pius X say? Within Gregorian chant, the qualities of sacred music are found in the highest degree. Those qualities we talked about. Holiness, soundness of form, and universality. Highest degree found in Gregorian chant, and making it the chant proper to the Latin. The more closely that a composition resembles the Gregorian mode, the more sacred and liturgical it becomes. Now, what does that say? That's saying you don't have to only do the old stuff, right? But it needs to look like the old stuff. And he lastly says here, the sacred music qualities are also possessed by an excellent degree of a classic polyphony, which reached its greatest perfection in the 16th century owing to Palestrina. So, you can see that whenever the Holy Mother Church is talking about Gregorian chant, it's how high it is. And then the next thing they throw in is sacred polyphony.
And actually, polyphony is the basis of business.
Yep.
It's like
Gregorian chant. Yep. Yep. Come up to it.
So let's talk a little bit about polyphony, because polyphony may be a bit of a foreign concept to some of you. So when you think about sacred polyphony, it was a natural, organic, Gregorian chant. And the difference, here's what it means. Gregorian chant is called plain chant, okay? It's homophony. It's one sound coming through. Versus polyphony, which is multiple sounds. And the way I love to describe it to people that don't understand it, you know, if you're a lady with lovely flowing long hair, all right, there are many things you can do with it. But if you want to make a tail, go deep. One way to do it is you just take one scrunchie and you put it on the back, and it's just one long piece, right? I think of that as Gregorian chant. Or you take three or four strands and you delicately interweave them together. That's what I think of whenever you see what picture in your mind. And so now, in order to keep you awake, we are going to talk a little bit more here about polyphony. So one of the things that started to happen as polyphony came into being, they started to interweave those parts together, is they started to get overly complex. And they started to get overly complex to such a point that the text was being lost. And what have we said since the beginning of our journey? The most important thing for liturgical music is the text. So if the music starts to interfere with the text, you have a problem. The other problem that was occurring in these early mid-16th century was that there were some very dubious foundational elements that was used to create the polyphony. So what was happening is some of these vulgar Latin drinking songs were being pulled in as the melody to create the polyphony. So that began to become a little bit of a problem. So because the foundation, and it was sort of as we were playing earlier, like we were going to that music. So when people were hearing that polyphony, they weren't hearing beautiful polyphonic music. They were hearing the vulgar drinking song just made fancy. So it's, once again, it's a matter of what you do when you take something profane and try to move it into the sacred. There's an issue. Now, some of the music now, we have no idea that it's from some vulgar drinking song, right? So for us, it's only beautiful. So in that case, context sometimes moves forward. And that was part of the problem. So at the Council of Trent, there was a massive debate about whether or not sacred polyphony should be allowed. And it was almost banned. It was almost another one of those moments, just like when the Jews decided they were going to do some speech, just like when the early church decided we're not having this Greek-Roman stuff in here, we're going to stick with the plain chant. This was another time where they almost said we're going to stop this polyphonic stuff because it doesn't work. And then Palestrina did a mass for them and showed them that if done well, the text comes blaring through the beautiful, beautiful words. So that was what, and so then Pope Pius V said, okay. He also put out the new missal at that time. And this is usually the time when most of our critics say, oh, that music, it's not that old. It just goes back to the 1500s. Only the 1500s. It's only 500 years old, and you're making it sound like it goes back to, you know, David and the sheep. It does go back to David and the sheep. It just happened to get restructured again, right? So let's help you understand a little bit about the difference between Gregorian chant and polyphony, if you want to. Gregorian chant, plain chant.
That was the...
Oh,
same, that was the same text. One was chant, one was polyphony. And in that polyphony, you could still hear the text all the way through it. We'll give you one more example. You can tell I like it because a little bit longer. So you can hear the text clearly, and once again you could hear those arches as it's coming up, lifting people up. So polyphony, the golden age of sacred polyphony, is really considered from about AD 1400 through 1600. And these are several of the composers that were known, and they're in chronological order. So you can see there were a couple of early folks, right? And then it got a lot thicker and a lot more work came out. And you've heard many of these pieces in what Greece has put together in the fine music program we have here. Morales, Palestrina, Lasso, Bird, Victoria, Mutar. There's just the Hassler. We love to do the three voice Hassler there. It's just beautiful stuff. And you can just see, if I get out of the shadow, you can just see where those place. And so this is the golden era of polyphony. So what sort of then happened? We talked about this being the golden era of polyphony. So then after you get from polyphony, you start to move into the Baroque and the Romantic era, so the 18th and 19th century. And you're probably going to recognize some of this, right? So this is starting to get into some of the orchestral stuff that we've heard. And the last Ascension Mass that we had here was Caldara. Okay, he was very early. This is in chronological order again. Caldara, we've heard some Mozart. We had a Michael Haydn here, I think the Ascension before that. So these are some of the Baroque folks. But it was during this time, and then after the Baroque gets into the classical age, but we started to run into problems. We started to run into problems. You know, the orchestral music was beautiful, but it started to overtake the text. And the other thing that started to happen is, if you think about the other thing that was really happening during this time, is the great operas. And what started to happen to sacred music is it got a little bit too operatic. And it started to have solos in it. And you had the big fat ladies singing, you know, at the end, right? And so this was an absolute deviation from what was supposed to be important, which was the text. And not a single person's voice, but a collective voice. So this is what started to happen as we started to get into the 18th and 19th, and then into the 18th and 19th centuries, right? And what was also happening is that a lot of these musics were starting to try to displace Gregorian chant. And so what was happening is how to sing Gregorian chant was being lost to all the mother church. And that how to do it or what books were available to do it began to be a problem. So we really start to get on some rocky ground now. And you think about it, we're now, you know, 1900 years away from the time that all of this started. And you do get growing pains. I know what I'm like. I'm nowhere near that many years. So next we have what was happening in the early 20th century. If you wanted to know what the state of sacred music was going into the early 20s, there was a little bit of a problem. Okay? Now, what did we do, or what was the attempt by Holy Mother Church? I'd like to call them the 3P. Pius X, Pius XI, Pius XII. Still wait for the 14th, man. I can't wait the Father Reed gets elected. But this is a period that I call the attempted restoration. And so what we had is Pius X in 1903 put out Tres Solicitudines. And with this, it was the first time really since Gregory I and the Council of Trent later on in the 16th centuries had put out something really big on sacred music. And at the beginning of this, I said there were 19 major things that came out. This is the first one that came out in that time frame. So what was the purpose? What did Pius X want to say here? He put this out because he wanted to maintain and promote the decorum in the house of God, which he thought was being lost. He said the purpose was to renew sacred music for liturgical service. Once again, we're not talking beautiful devotional music. This is for liturgical service. That any mass must be composed in an integrated fashion. Now, why was he saying that? Here's what was happening. Any of you who love classical music, right? In the big concertos, you know they have their movements. They have the Allegro movement, and then they have this movement. And then they have the different parts of a concerto. And when they were writing the masses, that's what they were doing. They would do one time here, and then do another one for the offertory, then do a different style over here. The mass lost its unity, which, as we remember, that is the soundness of form concept. Holy soundness of form means it's a unifying thing. If you ever hear us sing a piece of polyphony or even of the Gregorian chant, you're using the same piece usually all the way through the mass, which gives it a constant seamless thread all the way through. That's what soundness of form is doing, right? The other thing is that all percussive instruments were banned and forbidden in churches. So when you start to think about what might have been happening there with the timpani drums and all the other things, that were, once again, as we said, keeping people grounded, not lifting them up. Okay? And then the congregation itself should ideally be trained to sing the various modes of Gregorian chant with the choir. So what was happening here is all this beautiful operatic, soloistic music, the big orchestral stuff, the people sat there like dumb sheep. They couldn't sing it because, you know, it's way too complex for them. Right? So, it then, the other thing that he did is he kicked off a massive renewal of chant understanding and recodification of the chant. And, you know, we owe a lot of what Pius X did to his work, right? And certainly one of the areas that was done through the monks of Solen, who helped to put a lot of these books that we have now that were published, re-looking at the chants and what they were. So, and the way that we chant here at St. Anne's is from that Solen school in which we do it. So we can take that all the way back to Pius X. It was followed by Pius XI in 1928, so 25 years after Pius X put out this massive document, a beautiful thing about what music should be. 25 years later, Pius XI had to do it all over again. Why? Because he was deplored that sacred music laws of prior pontiffs in some places had not been fully observed due to disobedience. We've never heard that. parishes are doing what they want, right? In disobedience to the law of the church. Some even give countenance to the type of music. It should be altogether banned. He said, they're playing stuff that should be completely banned. He said, it's just dreadful stuff. It shouldn't be in our churches. He then again praised the greatness of Gregorian chant as the model, and he very nicely recognized my cousin Guido for his contribution to Gregorian chant and how it, the great benefit and glory of the church had been brought over the years. So that was in 1928, what Pius XI was trying to do. Next came Pius XII, and he wrote two encyclicals on sacred music. And he just says some beautiful stuff here, so you'll forgive me if I read some of this, but it's just, it's, if you let it sink in, it's really beautiful when you're trying to think about what music's supposed to be. He said, the laws and standards of religious art apply in a stricter and holier way to sacred music than other forms of art. Other forms of art being architecture and painting, you know, he says, that stuff's beautiful. He says, architecture is beautiful, art is beautiful, statuary is beautiful, but the rules should apply stricter and holier to sacred music because, while the latter, being the architecture and the paintings, prepare a worthy setting for the Mass, the sacred music importance is the actual performance of the rites, right? So, you could do this in the field if you don't have any beautiful art, but the music tied to the prayer text is what's important. That is why the rules of music are more important than the rules of what the architecture should be. And he further goes on to say, in order that singers and Christian people may rightly understand the meaning of the liturgical words joined to the musical melodies. I just love that phrase. Okay, let's say that again, right? Liturgical words joined to the melodies. And he wanted to make sure that the people understood them. What were the words tied to the melodies, right? And the first thing, you've got to be able to hear them. And then you have to be able to be smart enough to actively participate with the words. And we're going to get to some of that. So, what was the state of sacred music before Vatican II? Some of you in this room can correct me because maybe you go back further than that. But it was a work in progress, and here's one thing, right? The Mass, the ideal for the Mass is it should be a sung Mass, right? What we do here on Sundays, the Missa Cantata or Missa Solemne, that is the ideal, because everything that's being sung is part of the prayer of the Mass, right? At a low Mass, Father and the server are saying Mass. We're just there adding our prayers to it, but we are not really part of the Mass. So here's what was happening, right? Before Vatican II, there was a real lack of focus on training on schooling cantorum and choirs, and it led to a... So if no one can sing what they're supposed to be singing, you get stuck with the low Mass. But then what happened was these low Masses then turned in to the four-hem sandwich, okay? Where they started to sing vernacular homology, and they'd sing it at the beginning, and they'd sing it at the offertory time, they'd sing at communion, and they'd sing at the recessional. And they could do it, we could do it, because at a low Mass, you're not really part of the Mass. You're just sort of standing idle by like a sheep, but in this case, you're singing something completely different. And in most cases, it's words that aren't even related to the words that are actually the assigned prayer text that's in the Mass, because Father and the server are doing that themselves privately at the altar. But why we had gotten to this state is that there's just no investment in the music. And without the music, you cannot, without the musicians, you cannot do the sung Mass as it's to be done. And this is the way we were going into Vatican II, and this is going to help explain what some of the reforms were that were coming out, or were desired to come out of it. So that's where we are in our timeline now, right? We're moving into post-Vatican II time, 1960s, live free. Yes, fun time. So get ready. Get ready. Here. Now the fun starts. Now we can get people to get ready to walk out. No, just... So
You know, here's where people say, well, gosh, Stefano, yeah, you know, I hear everything you said to now, but I'm glad you finally got to the heart of the matter, because all that stuff that you talked about and that wonderful Pope, the 3P, that's all old, because everything changed in 1960. Everything changed. You know, Latin got thrown in the trash. We don't do Latin anymore. It's not supposed to be done. We do in the vernacular so people can understand it. Chant, forget about it. That's old. That's like Middle Ages. That's not hip. And even worse, it's Latin. And we just got rid of Latin. So we can't do Latin. And my wife's going to throw the bells and the incense away. You don't need any of that either. All right? So that's, you know, Stefano, you just need to get on board, because we're throwing open the doors of Holy Mother Church. We need new ideas to come in. We need new ideas. We've got to be open to it. We've got to be hip. We need more drums. Get rid of the organ. That's old. They don't even play that at baseball games anymore. You don't need an organ in the church. Don't need it. Okay.
Okay. I understand. This is what people think came out of the 1960s. This is what folks have been told for now 50 years.
That's actually true. A lot of this stuff on many, many different occasions, so let's not fool ourselves. This is very, very true about what you're saying. People may not be aware of it.
What I say, not true?
It's nonsense that it's coming from Vatican II.
Well,
so,
well we're going to... Let's see if it's molto vero. So, you know, because I could just be up here. I'm one of those radical traddies that, you know, that is just making stuff up, and I'm living back in 1903 on Pope Pius X's dogma, right? So fine, you got me. Let's go verbatim to the actual physical documents of Vatican II. Okay? Sacrosanta Concilia. This was the constitution of the sacred liturgy that was put out by the Second Vatican Council. Verbatim. Paragraph 36, particular law remaining in force, the use of Latin language is to be preserved in the Latin rites. Paragraph 54, in masses which are celebrated with the people, steps should be taken so that the faithful may also be able to sing together in Latin the parts of the ordinary of the mass that are proper to them. That means you are supposed to know what to do too. The Church acknowledges Gregorian chant as specifically suited to the Latin liturgy. Therefore, other things being equal, it should be given pride of place in the liturgical setting. And I said, well, you know, Stefano, I see what you're doing. You're picking and selecting stuff. Okay, let's look at the next paragraph. That's paragraph 116. 117. But other kinds of sacred music... Ooh, see? You can do other kind, but what are they saying? Especially polyphony. That's the exception they're making. And other music that fits the Gregorian mold that we've talked about. In the Latin Church, the pipe organ is to be held in high esteem, for it is the traditional musical instrument which adds wonderful splendor to the Church's ceremonies and powerfully lifts man's mind up to God. Think about it. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, music that is used outside of the world can't really be holy. Well, instruments are used outside of the world. And other than maybe an occasional ball game, an organ wasn't used, right? Organ was specifically, the pipe organ was specifically used for ecclesiastical setting. But other instruments may be admitted for use, but only on the condition that the instruments are suitable for sacred use. Right? Now, you're saying, don't shoot the messenger. This is what Vatican II actually said. So, you know, it's a little different than the spirit of Vatican II. It's a little bit different than the spirit of Vatican II. Now, you can say, well, Stefano, I see what you're doing. You're taking one of those constitutions that came out of the Second Vatican Council. But, you know,
there was actually instructions that got written, and that's really where people were told what to do based on that. So, yeah, that was coming out of the Constitution because we had a bunch of conservative hardliners that didn't want things to go their way. So, the instructions of what we were supposed to do. Okay, I'll take the bait. What were the instructions sent to every diocese regarding the Constitution we just saw? So let's talk about that. Liturgical worship is given more noble form when it is celebrated in song with the ministers fulfilling their ministry and the people in it. So there it's saying you should be singing the Mass and that the people have a role to play here. So let's just keep that one in mind. The faithful fulfill their liturgical role by making full, conscious, and active participation, which should above all be internal. Above all, internal. On the other hand, external. The faithful should be taught to unite themselves interiorly to what the ministers or choir sing so that they listen to them and they may rise to the mind, their minds to God. All right? This gets to the heart of active participation. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But here's the thing. Part of that is listening to what's being sung. People say, I don't understand Latin. I don't understand Latin. What? There's a missal. There's a paper. There's an English beside it. Read that before Mass and then listen to it. That is putting your mind actively participating in what's being sung. This says you should participate, should be taught to unite themselves interiorly, right? It is.
It was actuoso, which means a contemplative participation. And it didn't say activo. It said actuoso.
It can say actuoso. You know, I wasn't going to get it in translation, but you can still read it in context, right? And see that it's talking about interior, and it says above all interior, right? Which includes, and I didn't have it in paragraph 30 of the Constitution, it talks about the importance of sacred silence. There is moments in the Mass where there should be nothing happening so that you can take the Blessed Sacrament, come back to your pew, and have a moment to reflect. It's something that Jesus does faithfully here. Those aren't times when we run out of music. Well, maybe sometimes. But no, it's meant to be quiet. There are times in the traditional form of the Mass, in the Latin Mass, some of you may be participating. Because what I'm saying goes for the Novus Ordo. I'm not talking about anything here that's separated from it, right? This isn't just a Latin Mass thing or an extraordinary form. This is Novus Ordo as well. So, but, you know, you have the canon in the silence. And Father talked about that before during the silence. You know, we stop singing. You are forbidden in the Latin Mass, in the extraordinary form, to do anything during the consecration. Because we should all be participating interiorly. The great mystery of Christ our Lord done on the altar, right? So, what's another paragraph say? Where the vernacular has been introduced, it may be opportune to preserve one or more Masses celebrated in Latin, especially the Sun Masses. So here's what they're saying here. Okay, they understood that there were going to be some low Masses. We'll do some of those in English, or French, or Italian. But there should be some Masses, at least one, maybe more, and they should be in Latin. The sung liturgical service celebrated in Latin with Gregorian chant should be given pride of place. And then here's a big one. In order to preserve the heritage of sacred music, the study and trace of Gregorian chant should be promoted. Special characteristics. And see, this is where I would employ you. If you like what you have here at St. Anne's, or you're from another parish, you need to support your music ministries. You need to support them. You need to support them the same way as you would art. Because what did we hear up here earlier? Art and statuary are beautiful. Father, look at me for this. But what is music is what's tied to the text. Music is actually integral to the Mass. It is not separate and apart from. It is integral to it. And that's what they're saying here is people need to preserve that sacred music heritage. Musical instruments can be very useful. The pipe organ is to be held in high esteem. So once again, even in the instruction.
in permitting and using musical instruments, which are suitable for those instruments who are suitable for secular music only, are prohibited. Okay? They didn't want things that would remind you of the outside world at church. They don't want you to be thinking of the outside world. They don't want you to think about Dorothy and the rainbow. They don't want you to be thinking about the ragtime piano, okay? You should be lifting your mind up. This is the importance of this, right? So, just in summary of the Vatican II teachings, right? Latin should continue to be used as a universal language. Gregorian chants, sacred polyphony should continue to be used. New compositions are welcome. Didn't say you couldn't do it, but they have to conform to the definition of sacred tradition, of sacred music, and to the Gregorian mode. Organ can be used, and other instruments should be limited. People have an active, participative role in knowing, understanding, and singing that which pertains to them, especially the responses in the ordinary in Latin. That's your job, to know how to do that.
So,
yes, Father.
The ordinary masses.
Coming right up, Father. So, because what we want to do is now, how do we relate sacred music to the sacrifice of the Mass? Alright? And if you don't remember anything, this is some of the key stuff, right? The Mass is a sung prayer. From the beginning to the end, everything that you hear chanted almost invariably is a song. It comes from the Psalms, it's being sung. And the text, because it's prayer, is most critical. It's the text that's important. The only time in the Bible when Jesus is set and him sung was at the Last Supper. We all know that was the institution of the priesthood, the institution of the Mass, right? When they had sung the hymn, they went off to the Mount of Olives. The one reference to our Lord Jesus Christ singing, and it was in the context of the Last Supper. Pope Pius says, sacred music, special power, and excellence lift up the minds of the faithful who are present. Song represents prayer text. Therefore, it is prayer coming from the heart of man through his voice to God's ears. Listen how beautiful that is, right? It's prayer coming from the heart of man through man's voice to God's ears. That's what sacred music is doing in the Mass. It's taking our prayer to God's ear. And that is why the human voice is so important, right? The human voice is what is most important in sacred music. Here's what Pius XI said. Voices, rather than instruments, ought to be heard in church. This is just beautiful. For no instrument, however perfect, however excellent, can surpass the human voice in expressing human thought, especially when it's used by the mind to offer up prayer and praise to Almighty God. That's just beautiful terms, right? What they're saying. But our voice, because it's man's voice and it's man's thoughts, lifting that up to God's ears, right? An instrument can't do that for man. So the human voice is what is important. If music, instrument or vocal, does not possess at the same time a sense of prayer, dignity, and beauty, it precludes entry into the sphere of the sacred and the religious. This is one of the reasons why you can't hook up a microphone system and play music for Mass, right? You can't have recorded music for Mass. It has to come from him because it's spontaneous prayer. It's contemporaneous prayer, right? So, that brings us to a very important concept that we already have. Active participation. What does this mean? It's not that you need to be doing something all the time. That's not what it's all about. Holy Mother Church talks about active participation in the following way. There are 3 degrees of participation the first degree, if something is in the first degree of participation, the faithful should always sing. If it's in the second degree, the faithful should sing it unless it's a very complex, multi-voice or polyphonic piece, right? And then the third degree, the faithful should sing it if it's easily arranged, but it's likely to be preserved, be reserved for the scholar cantor, for the choir, right? So those are the assigned degrees. If it's a first degree, you should sing. Even if you think you can't. Even if you're a man and you think men don't sing. That's pulling in the church says if it's a first degree, you should sing. Second degree, you should sing. Third degree, maybe not, but let's see. So how does that relate to what's in the Mass? And this gets to Father's question, right? The structure of the Mass is made up of three components, right? The order of Mass, which is found in the Missal, the Missale Romano, which sits upon the altar for Father. Those are where the priest's prayers are that he sings, or prays silently. And the dialogues. Dominus Vobiscum, et cum spiritu tuo, that's a dialogue, right? The ordinary of the Mass, the Father said, well, what's the ordinary? Because we just learned, we're supposed to know the ordinary, right? The ordinary are those parts of the Mass that do not change. They are the same today, tomorrow, yesterday, regardless mostly of the feast, right? And they include the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Credo, the Sanctus, the Agnus Dei. Those are the five things that are made up of the ordinary, that are unchanging. And then you have, and they're found in something called the Kyriade Romana, if you really want to do. And then the proper of the Mass. These are the prayers that change depending on the Mass. What day of the Mass, what saint's been celebrated, those change. Those are proper. And those are the introit, the gradual, the alleluia, the offertory, and the communion. Okay? So when you think of the structure of the Mass, these are the elements. Okay, thank you, Stefano. You just told me the structure of the Mass. How does that compare to the degrees, right? Here you go. Your singing participation at the Mass should look like this. The ordinary of the Mass, for the dialogues, you should always be singing. You absolutely should be singing them. The ordinary of the Mass, which is the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Credo, you should be singing that, especially if it's one of the easier Gregorian ones. And to make it easy on you, you have this book in those places you sit. They're called pews, and then in front there's this book thing here. And in here, on page 159, is where you can begin to see the ordinary of the Masses that we sing. Mass 1, Mass 7, Mass... So you have it right here, so you can look at it if you don't know. It's usually a pin onto the board which Mass we're doing. We tend to do the same Mass over. Second degree, you should be singing. The propers in the Mass, the introit, the gradual, you'll probably rarely sing those. If we were ever to do some more simplified ones maybe, but these tend to be reserved for the scola. But you still have a role. You do not have a singing role in this, but you have a role to understand what the scola is singing and what it means, because it's part of the prayer. It's part of the Mass and the prayer. All right? And then if you're still thinking, did you think that answered the question, Father? So if you're still thinking, Stefano, you're up there, and you hate Vatican II, you're just moving on, you just didn't get with it. Paul VI really wasn't a fan. Okay. You're right. Paul VI was so opposed that he sent in 1974 a letter to the bishops saying, and he sent them a free gift with the minimum repertoire of Gregorian chant that every parish and every Catholic should know on the planet. He wanted to make it easier for Christians to achieve unity and spiritual harmony with their brothers. One of the reasons he was doing this is 1975 was going to be a holy year. And so when everyone went to Rome, this was the first big holy year after Vatican II, he wanted everyone to be able to be united, universal, Catholic, right? To be able to be with their brothers in the living tradition of the past. Those who are trying to improve the quality of the congregational singing cannot refuse Gregorian chant's place, which is due to it. And the best way of teaching the faithful Latin chants, Jubilate Deo, and have them sing. And what's Jubilate Deo? This was the free gift. This was the free gift that went to the diocese of the minimum repertoire that you should know as Catholics. And it's a mighty pittance of the repertoire when you compare these two books. Okay. That was 1974. When people were still saying that wasn't us. So, now the part you really do wait for. In closing, what sacred music is not? Okay? Sacred music is not a preference. It is not a personal preference. I don't really like that kind of music. Sorry. I'm in a different song. Sorry. It's not a preference. It is a signed prayer text given by Holy Mother Church. It really makes someone like Teresa's job a lot easier because she doesn't have to figure out what song she's going to sing. She's told. 10 Sunday post Pentecost, you're going to sing these. This is the text you're supposed to sing. And everyone on the planet who's a Catholic should be singing that same text. Might be the different melodies, but that's the same text. It's not a preference. And the problem is when we replace it with hymns, hymns are at best paraphrased. And at worst, they're heretical. Right? The other thing, sacred music is not a performance. It's not. It's not a performance. Right? It is an integral, it is integrated liturgical prayer wrapped in musical melodies. What the choir sings may be gorgeous, but it's gorgeous prayer. Now, after Mass, you want to go? Some of you know that was good. The prayer text that you sang today was just fantastic. Thank you. This is the beauty of choir reps, in my mind, right? Because it takes the choir off of the stage where people tend to, when you're on stage, they look, they watch. They're used to going to concerts, they're used to having mosh pits, right? They want to applaud. And here's what the thing, here's what Benedict said about applause. Whenever applause breaks out in the liturgy, when it breaks out in the liturgy because of a human achievement, Father said a really good homily, or we sang a really pretty song, okay? A human achievement, if the applause breaks out, it's a sure sign that the essence of the liturgy has been lost, has totally disappeared and been replaced with a kind of religious entertainment. Father and Teresa are not there to entertain you. They are there to offer the Mass. They're there to offer the Mass. Now, you want to tell us how wonderful we are after? Great. Give him my email. If you don't like it, offer it. So let's see, because we said stuff, we said in closing, when are you going to get there? Huh? Hold on, almost there. But we have to talk about the great Saint John Paul II on the 100th anniversary of Pius X's beautiful encyclical. This is what John Paul II said in 2003. The contamination of profane theatrical music that in many countries has polluted the repertoire of the sacred liturgy. So even in 2003, we still have problems, right? Not all expressions of music are able to express adequately the mystery of the Church's faith. The sacred context of celebration must never become a laboratory for experimentation. It should never become a laboratory for experimentation. Once again, it's sung prayer text. That's what we should be taking away from it. And that is why how John Paul opened this right was the musical tradition of the universal church is a treasure of inestimable value. greater than any other art. The main reason is the preeminence is that sacred melody tied to the words forms an integral part of the song lyrics. There it is again, right? Even more than paintings, more than architecture, more than statues. Sacred music because it's integral and tied with words to the song lyrics. That is the heart of sacred music. That is its purpose. That is what I think. I could be biased, but I don't think so. We do it very well in science. Thanks to the ocean, our Father, and Therese, and what this tradition does. And living what Holy Mother Church teaches that definition is. So with that, I thank you. I'm happy to take my yes.
You know, I noticed I went to one of the masses where they had Mozart, Beethoven, and Ludwig. There are many parts of the Latin Mass that are supposed to be contemplative. We're actually supposed to participate in a contemplative state, especially if we can, because it's something supernatural happening. And I noticed that the ordinary music puts you the other music almost interferes, but there's something glorious about chant that puts you in that state, so you're able to participate more in a contemplative state.
Yeah, I mean, each person does have a filter, but I think it takes out some of the extreme. You know, when you start to compare it to a Mozart mass, you know, if you think about our timeline, you start moving into that Mozart, you are starting to get into where it does get into more, it can tend to start to get into more interference than strict classical polyphony or regular plain chant. You know, I often will hear people say that. Yes? No, there was some time after the Reformation, because really the time of the Reformation and the Council of Trent was really the Counter-Reformation was really a wonderful period. It was after that, because classical polyphony really took off. It was an outcry during the Counter-Reformation. It really stemmed some of the Protestant stuff. It was much later that you started to see the more operatic and the classical, in the soloistic elements into it. It was much later than that, actually. Any other questions? Yes.
Each Sunday, you know, we have a basket with the propers when you walk into the narthex. And then on that basket, some Sundays, I think you have something with the sacred music, like with the mass setting. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what I was talking about. You know, your part is to be able to sing the ordinary, the Kyrie, you know, when you're supposed to sing it. And what we usually pin on the basket is which mass, because there are different masses, different types of masses that are numbered for the Gregorian styles. And then we say what page number, so that you're able to follow in the book and begin to learn it and to understand it. Yeah, that's exactly what that is. And I encourage you to take the propers that are in that basket or in your missal, because that will help you understand and actively participate contemplatively in what is being said at the mass.
So interesting about Kyrie.
Yeah, it's the only part of the, because the other part is when we do the Good Friday services in Greek too. That is the only part of the Mass.
Well, on
the Latin. On the Latin, right, it's in Greek. Right. Other question? So what I thought would be appropriate, you know, just so that, you can, sort of give some credence to yourselves and to my cousin Guido, is you all have this. I think it would be appropriate for us to stand and let us offer the great prayer of solemnity that I'm sure you all know, that you can follow it, I think, now in Gregorian chant to actually follow the square notation. You ready? Salve Regina,
Mater Misericordiae.
Thank you very much. And for those of you who want, I have sort of summaries of what I talked about today that you can take and you can challenge and you can look at, and there's other research information, and you can look at some of the research materials. Thank you. Have a good night.